Hello, friends. My name is Allison Bauer, and I'm the pastor at Second Presbyterian Church in Portsmouth, Ohio. And with me today is Dr. Stan Workman.
Hello.
Who is the director of music and my partner in crime at Second Pres.
Oh, yes.
And this is something new for us. We're recording a podcast leading up to one of our major musical performances, which I affectionately refer to as extanaganzas. And so we're doing this in order to advertise the event, spread the word, and to provide some history, background, and context of this performance. So today we're talking about our Good Friday performance at Second Pres on March 29th of Johann Sebastian Bach's monumental composition known as the St. John Passion, which is celebrating its 300th anniversary this year. And Stan, that's probably a good place to start our conversation with the title of this piece. So we know that it's called the St. John Passion. And I know what we usually mean when we use the word passion these days, something like extreme enthusiasm or love for someone or something. We'll say it that way. But I don't think that's what Bach had in mind. So what does the word passion mean in this musical context?
Well, not only Bach, but the original meaning of the word used today is quite different from what we think of the meaning today. We think of an intense emotion, desire, inclination, feeling. But the original meaning of the word referred to the sufferings and death of Christ on the cross. And this term was also extended to refer to the sufferings of the martyrs.
Mm.
The use of the word as we know it today came into usage in the 16th century in Shakespeare. And began to refer to sexual love and a sense of strong liking or enthusiasm, which, of course, is seemingly the opposite of its original use. But more relevant to our cause is the passion narrative that is gathered from the Gospels and meant to be performed during Holy Week church services. It originated in the medieval era as early as the 4th century and began as an intoned or chanted reading. Later, the readings were divided into parts and developed in what may be described as a passion play with polyphonic musical settings and hymns added to them. This is the forerunner to the great passions settings of Bach, with composers over the centuries adding to the various elements of the genre. And there were many settings of the passion by composers before and after Bach. But his passions represent the pinnacle of the genre. He composed 5, according to his obituary, which was written by his son, but only St. John and St. Matthew remain, though a libretto of the St. Mark Passion was found and music of Bach's was arranged around it.
Wow.
Yes, a lot of information there.
Well, that's just quite a history of where things have started and how they have evolved over the years, musically especially, the changes from chanting to what we have today.
Right.
I am glad to be one of the singers in the choir for this event, and the choir is made up of our choir from Second Pres and our friends from other church choirs, and the choir students from Shawnee State University. And in rehearsals, you have talked a lot about Bach's skills with word painting, and that might be something that people who are listening might not know much about. So can you explain what word painting means and what listeners should be looking for or listening for in the music?
Right. Composers from the Renaissance era on, which is where there was a rediscovery of thinking from ancient times, particularly the Greeks, and the impact that Greek drama had upon its listeners. And so artists began to study the elements of that type of drama, and they began to work with the concepts of rhetoric, which was an important element of Greek drama. And so part of that became what you might say the basic toolbox of Renaissance and Baroque composers. And it extended even into the classical era, Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven. And then with the initiation of the Romantic era, it became less and less a thing, although it certainly did not completely die out. But Bach, of course, was a master of everything that he touched. And so one only has to have your ears ready to listen to encounter. For instance, there's an aria by the mezzo-soprano in which she talks about being bound in the bondage of sin, being entwined in it. And we have two oboes that are neatly entwining each other with counterpoint.
Oh, nice.
And then eventually it loosens. In the aria that follows right after, it's the soprano singing a response to Peter saying he will follow Christ everywhere. And there is literally quite a bit of following. And in one part of the text, it says, "And if I should lag, then pull me up." And the music literally does that. It starts moving in half steps as if it was lagging to its goal. And then it reaches that. So another place is in the soprano aria, which comes toward the end, in which she describes melting into tears. And the woodwind instruments that are accompanying it literally are sobbing. And so, you know, this is only a tip of the iceberg. The chorus has so many elements that point out the drama, his use of harmony and chromaticism to describe pain and, you know, acrimony, you know, these are all the skillful tools that Bach uses to create a great picture.
Yes.
Musically.
Some of the rehearsal times, it's some of those parts that it's just chromatic after, and it's crunchy notes and it's chords, and you know it's the right thing, but it's so painful to listen to. And you keep saying, "That's the point. You're singing about painful things. It should sound painful." So I appreciate that. So I'm hoping I'm singing the correct painful notes. But that's why we keep practicing. Some people 2 times a week, sometimes 3 times a week, sometimes 4 times a week people are rehearsing for this.
Right,
so
right.
This is a pretty monumental undertaking, but it's definitely worth it. I think the next thing I want to ask you about is something we've talked about leading up to this, and part of the reason why we're doing this podcast is, unfortunately, the crime, and I will say the sin, of anti-Semitism is currently on the rise in our world, and particularly in our country. And just to make sure that everybody's on the same page, I looked up on the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, and they define anti-Semitism. They say it was coined only in the 19th century, while noting that anti-Jewish hatred and Judeophobia, which is fear of Jews, date back to ancient times and have a variety of causes. And unfortunately, sometimes people will point to the Bible as one of those causes, and they'll specifically look at the language from John's gospel. And since this is the St. John Passion, we know that Bach uses texts from chapters 18 and 19 as he's telling this Passion story. So this issue of anti-Semitism and people using John to justify hatred of the Jews, I know this is important to both of us, but particularly to you because of your relationship with the Jewish temple in town. You have been with Second Prez for 30 plus years. You have also been their music director for over 30 years. So as we are preparing this, I was wondering, what kinds of things are you doing to make sure that people walk away from this performance understanding that we shouldn't blame or hate all Jews for, quote unquote, killing Jesus?
Yeah, I really cherish my relationship with the Jewish temple here in town, and I consider it a great honor to be their cantor, their music director, and it's just been a wonderful thing that has enriched my life as well. But this is what I would say to begin this would be sigh, because as glorious as John's gospel is, there is the Jews has become a group that everyone that has rejected Christ is lumped into. And we are told that about that time, the Gospel of John that was being finished, there was an expulsion from the temple of those Jews that believed that Jesus was the Messiah, and that there was a great deal of acrimony over this. Some scholars debate the verity of this, though it would make sense in explaining why there is the collective, the Jews, seemingly responsible for everything that's negative. However, anti-Semitism is wrong.
Mm.
And it's bone-chilling to me that the scriptures could be used against any group of people.
Mm.
My personal belief is that God's plan of salvation is broader than we can comprehend, and blaming any group of people for the death of Jesus is entirely wrong.
Mm.
Now, as to Bach's just St. John Passion, while Bach used the bald narrative in the Gospel of St. John, and by the way, he didn't really have a choice. He was managed by a town council who often were very critical, and so he would have been forced to follow the bald narrative as I described it,
mm-hmm.
not changing anything. And of course, in his music, he captures all the ferocity of the mob's actions. In most instances, he seems to be more concerned with the congregation that is listening, placing the blame on all of us and our sins as the cause of Jesus' suffering. I think it's important to note that most mainline churches have repudiated these issues, much in the way that they have moved away from the scriptures regarding slavery, women's rights, and same-sex relationships. Yet, there are significant steps in the right direction and still need to be more discussed and talked, and actually actions need to happen.
Mm.
In the aria, My Dearest Savior, the bass soloist asks concerning Jesus' death, is redemption of all the world here? And then it proclaims the answer, yes. And I would say this is a prayer for all of us.
Oh, yeah.
And we need to keep working on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I always, when this comes up in conversation and people start to say things that maybe sound like blaming the Jews for things, I always say, you would have done the same thing.
Yeah.
You would have been caught up in the mob mentality and the fear that permeated that day, and you would have been yelling crucify just like everybody else.
And there's no verification that there weren't non-Jews in the mob.
Yes. Oh, everybody was coming out for public executions.
Right.
There were all kinds of people that were going to stand there and watch that happening.
And, you know, so.
Yes. Well, I think that's an important issue, and I appreciate the thought that you have put into that. The next question that I have for you, as I have been reading and studying the background of this, is hearing what it would have been like to attend a Good Friday performance of the St. John Passion back when it was first written 300 years ago. So I'm curious what it would have been like back then, but then for the people who are listening, it probably would be helpful for them to have an expectation of what it will be like when they're with us in our sanctuary on Good Friday experiencing the same performance.
Right. Well, in 1724 Leipzig, congregants would have gone to church probably about 3 o'clock when we are having our performance, and they would have been there probably for at least 4 hours.
Ooh.
Yes. And consider the fact that the St. John Passion is 2 hours and 15 minutes approximately.
Mm-hmm.
But they would have had a preceding portion of service that led up to the first part of St. John. So they would have sung a hymn. They would have listened to scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first part of St. John would have been performed. And then at the end of the first part, there would have been a sermon.
All right.
And,
but we're not doing that, right?
No.
Thank you.
But the sermons in that time period, I am sure, lasted much longer than those that we hear today.
Yes, I'm sure.
So add another 40, 45 minutes, I would say, onto that, and then begin the second part of St. John. And then there would have been a follow-up service, you might say, to the ending of St. John. And so, like I say, it would probably have been at least 4 hours in church. I think the idea was to, you know, the Vesper service led to sundown, you know, so that's not the reason for the length, but it kind of dovetails into that.
Sure, so. Kind of moving into that Easter vigil sense of that Holy Saturday. Yeah. Now, this is a question I didn't have written down, but I have read that during one of these performances, it would have been the congregation that would have been singing a lot of the chorales that the choir is singing. And I hope that's true, because I actually leaned over and told somebody at choir last night, you know, the congregation would have been singing this if we'd have been back in the 1700s. Was that a common practice, or was that maybe just a random thing I read somewhere?
That's, there is not a complete verification of that, whether the congregation sang along. It would have been the printed in the program, and of course, the congregation would have been familiar with the chorales, just as we are familiar with hymn texts.
Right.
So when those texts came up, they would have been very familiar with them. As to whether they sang, like I said, we don't have real proof that they would have sung along. Someone might have sung along, you know, but as a general congregation, we don't have exact knowledge of that. At the same time, you know, that's it's a part of the music, the service, that definitely the congregation could relate to.
Sure.
So, you know, that's, you know, there are many questions we have, but we just don't have
the answers. Right. Well, for anybody who's listening, the choir will be doing all of the heavy lifting during this service. There's no need to sing along if you don't want to.
And it's an interesting fact, too, that in those performances, everyone in the choir would have been one of the soloists, or, you know, the evangelist might have also performed the tenor arias. The person singing the role of Jesus might have been the bass soloist, and they probably were a member of the choir. So, you know, there were limited forces that could perform these great works. And nowadays, we divide them out into individual singers and... you know, so that's the modern practice of that.
So a performance here is going to leave out all those extra service parts, but it will just be the music in the middle. And
that's right.
So part one and then part two, and there'll be a brief pause in between that's probably not going to be super long.
Right.
So we think it's important for people to know what they're getting themselves into. This is a bit of a commitment, but we think it's a commitment that's worth making. So my final question is, this performance is going to happen at 3 p.m. on Good Friday, in keeping with, you said, is Bach's intention of when it would start. What do you think he hoped people would experience or take away from this performance of the St. John Passion? And then what are you hoping people take away with them after their experience here?
Well, let me say a couple things about Bach. You know, people tend to make him into a god, which he was not. He was a man, and we know he had a temper.
And,
but we also know that he was a Jedi, somewhat, of music. He represented both the past, the present, and the future of music, and this is evidenced in his compositions. Seems to be almost a supernatural quality about them, and the quality and the craftsmanship, the architecture. For instance, the libretto is listed as anonymous, but we now believe that Bach actually wrote the libretto, and he probably derived his inspiration from different poems and put it together, and he chose the specific chorales, which are mostly written in the 16th and 17th century, but he left credit to anonymous, probably so he wouldn't have any criticism.
Right.
and this is an important factor to remember, that, you know, while we revere Bach as sort of the father of of music in many ways, he was not quite as well beloved,
right,
as we treat him today. And it has taken, it took probably, you might say, 60 to 70 years after his death for his music to start to be really appreciated. His skill in harmony and counterpoint was always revered. And of course, during his lifetime, he was known more than a composer, but more as a virtuoso at the organ and the harpsichord. And so, there were no persons that could equal him. But as a composer, he, as I said, represented the past, present, and future. And sometimes the music didn't necessarily appeal to the minds at that time, the people listening. And but this is often the case with great art, the appreciation for it comes later.
No prophet is welcome in his own hometown, as the scriptures say as well.
And I think it's interesting to note, you know, the two great passions that we have remaining, St. John and St. Matthew, and they are quite different because St. Matthew was only had minor changes over his life, whereas St. John Passion is a work that he revised many times over its performance history. And the version that we'll be doing is from 1749, and it probably wasn't performed during his lifetime, but it represents his final intentions. And like I say, it's something he went back to and constantly tinkered, probably more so than any other composition that he wrote, you know. And so it's a fascinating thing about it. You know, the music itself consists of these glorious choruses bookending the whole work. Then there are the narratives and the recitatives by the characters, and the arias, which are commenting on the action, and the chorales, which bring us to a present day reflection on the meaning of the narrative and the arias that have just been sung. So it's really a multifaceted work, and it's very thoughtful. And as I said, Bach was not a perfect man, but we do know that he was very devout and he was very scholarly about theology and had many books that he have writing in them that we know he studied them. And so it's a fascinating thing about Bach. And so in a lot of ways, he was humble in his, he considered it, you know, his job to do this.
Right.
There was no like great aspirations, like I'm going to write the greatest piece of music
ever. Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, but those things came out of him. We know that he, when he went to Leipzig, he had to start writing cantatas for Sunday morning worship, right away, and so we know that he wrote these masterpieces probably within a span of, you know, 2 or 3 days with the family copying all the parts, you know, and it's a good thing he had a large family. A
lot of kids.
Right. And so, yeah, it's an amazing thing about Bach.
Well, that would be an interesting perspective to listen to this. And it will maybe change how I listen even as we rehearse, that like, this is just his humble offering. Like, this is his humble offering of faith, but also just part of his job. Like, it's part of what was expected, which I will dwell more in the humble offering part than the, than, as you say, like, wanting to create this masterpiece.
Yeah, there was, I don't think there was necessarily that aspiration, although I won't go so far as to say it was all humility.
Sure.
I think Bach enjoyed his skills, and I think he definitely knew what he was about.
Right.
And so, and he never really wavered from that. You know, there were different trends going on during his lifetime, and he pretty much stayed with his ideas about music and mm-hmm. also perfecting things like counterpoint, the fugue.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Just all the things that his hands touched.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like, and what I'm looking forward to is what an immersive musical experience this will really be. How I really hope people are just drawn into the story in a way that they've never been before, listening to the choir. But then, as you say, having the soloist portraying different characters and like watching the hearing the conversation and hearing the choir, you know, the directions you've given us of like, you're an angry mob, yell. I'm sure that was probably part of his intention back in the day, but I suspect that's a big part of why we're doing it also, is to provide this experience of the agony and the suffering of the passion story on Good Friday, that maybe will touch people in a way that just reading the words by yourself on a page hasn't done for someone.
Right. And there's a reason why these works have endured, because they are of monumental quality.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's a great thing if we can look at the texts, particularly of the arias, and see how they reflect what has gone on in the actual story.
Mm-hmm.
And it should definitely deepen the meaning
mm-hmm.
of the work. It's just not impressive music.
Mm-hmm.
It's impressive music with a lot and many layers of meaning.
Yes. There've been a couple times here at the university when I've been with the students singing and somebody will turn to me and say, I want this played at my funeral. This is amazing, beautiful music.
Yeah.
And I think, what are the chances of someone in 2024 wanting a 300-year-old Bach piece played at their, I mean, there's just connections that are being made that I think reinforce why it's important to not forget about the masterpieces
right.
from years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, this has been great, Stan. I've really appreciated that you were willing to do this, that you were willing to let me drag you into yet another new adventure. This time into the world of podcasts, which is where I spend a lot of time listening to them, but I don't spend a lot of time recording them. But to those of you who are listening, we hope to see you on Good Friday, March 29th at 3 p.m. at Second Prez on Waller Street for our performance of Bach's St. John Passion. It will feature a choir full of our favorite people from the church and our community and the students here, excellent soloists, some who faces you will recognize and some faces that will be new to you. We're also glad to welcome our friend Dr. Jerry Martin on the organ, as well as an orchestra that will fill up the sanctuary with a lot of sound that day. This performance is free and open to the public, and we hope that it will deepen your understanding and experience of both the agony of the crucifixion on Good Friday, as well as the celebration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ on Easter Sunday. And if I wouldn't be a pastor worth my salt if I didn't also say, if you're looking for a place to worship on Easter Sunday, we'll be gathering at Second Prez at 9:30 a.m., and there is a place for you with us.
So March 29th at 3 p.m.
Did I say that wrong earlier?
No.
Oh.
I still think.
March 29th at 3 p.m. You might want to come a little early. Parking spots may be at a premium. Doors will open at what time?
Probably 2.
Okay.